Dexter Gordon was a legendary saxophonist, a major innovator of modern jazz, and an Oscar-nominated actor. He also was a complicated man who struggled with drugs and incarceration and had to battle the racism of his era. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. My guest today is Maxine Gordon, widow of the late Dexter Gordon and a jazz scholar herself. Her New York Times acclaimed book is entitled Sophisticated Giant, The Life and Legacy of Dexter Gordon. Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you, Emily.
So if you were on a plane as part of your book tour and the person sitting next to you asked what you are doing and you said you're promoting your book on Dexter Gordon, your late husband, and they said, who's Dexter Gordon?
Mm-hmm.
If you had just a minute to answer, how would you answer that?
What a good question, because that happens
all
the time. People would be like, oh, you know, where are you going and why? And I've been asked often, who is Dexter Gordon? So what I say to somebody who doesn't necessarily know anything about jazz or him, I say, well, he was a jazz musician who began his career when he was a teenager and had a very illustrious career. He's an iconic figure in jazz history. He played the tenor saxophone. And then later in his life, he made a movie and was nominated for Best Leading Actor in that movie. And he was only the fifth black actor nominated at that time before Denzel won. And that he began his autobiography before he died, and then asked me, would I promise to finish it? And I did promise, and then this is the book.
So when Dizzy Gillespie said about Dexter, he did everything wrong and it all turned out right, what did he mean?
Yeah, I love that quote. Actually, in the book there are numerous quotes from Dizzy Gillespie, who Dexter referred to as the Albert Einstein of modern music. And he also said that there were only two people who could really play bebop, and that was Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker, and everybody else was trying to catch up. But and he loved Dizzy. And what he means when he says that is that Dexter is like the Phoenix Rising. So he's born in L.A. His father was the second black doctor. He went on the road with the big hit band, Lionel Hampton, when he's 17. But then he got involved with drugs. So he has this period starting about 48 to 60, the whole decade of the 50s, where he's incarcerated. And he's a drug user, and it's like totally, he's stuck in L.A. He can't leave Los Angeles. He's on parole. He didn't record. He didn't, you know, go out really at all. And so he was very involved in drugs. And then we would do 90 days in the L.A. County Jail, get out, go back, and be on parole. So it was this very difficult period. And then once he got out of that, he left the country for 14 years, and he lived in Copenhagen. And Dizzy said, you know, when you look around and then you're like, where's Dexter? He comes back, and he comes back better than he was when he left. And mm-hmm. So in 1988, we went on a jazz cruise, and Dizzy was on there and the Modern Jazz Quartet. It was like this kind of jazz reunion for them, and they got a chance to be together. And Dizzy said, well, you know, you should have won the Oscar. I mean, we want, you know, the relationship was so great. But he was so happy for Dexter that things, you know, turned around. And which you don't always see people in a kind of group situation where they're happy for each other when one does better. And, you know, so, but in that group of jazz musicians, you know, they all were so, they felt, when Dexter did well, they were doing well.
That's great. You know. And Dexter was born in 1923 and got going with the Lionel Hampton band when he was 17 or
yeah,
something like that.
Yeah.
Is there a recording from the early period of Dexter's life that gives us some sense of what his sound was like when you can say that's the Dexter Gordon sound?
Right. Yeah, I would say the recording on Savoy Dex's deck is a very good example. And in the book, There's one of the great quotes that comes from Jimmy Heath, the great saxophonist and composer, arranger, where he says, John Coltrane and I sat in my mother's living room listening to Dexter Savoy recordings over and over and over, and they sometimes would have to go buy another one because the 78 would wear out before LPs. Mm-hmm. And he said, and that's when we decided to switch from alto saxophone to tenor saxophone, which is like the moment in jazz history if John Coltrane had stayed an alto player instead of a tenor player. And the reason they switched was because of Dexter. So, and then, we know that John Coltrane and Sonny Rollins are influenced by Dexter, and then he's influenced by them. So, Dexter's Dick.
There's another quote you include from Jimmy Heath in the book. When Dexter played, everybody listened. He could really power you off the stage if you were up there with him. Long, tall Dexter, he will never be forgotten.
Mm-hmm. That's so great.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jimmy Heath was one of the most helpful people to me with the book. And he kept saying, you have to get it right. You have to get it right. Don't write the standard biography. He's born, he went on the road, he made these records, he died. You know, a tragic death. He was like, oh dear, he didn't die a tragic death. He had a happy ending. But what I just wanted to say was the personnel on Dex's Deck, which is Dexter's original tune, is Gene Ramey on bass, I looked it up, Ed Nicholson on drums, and Argon Thornton on piano, who becomes, I think, Hadith Sakim. He becomes a Muslim. But because it was very important to Dexter, always mention the personnel in every band and every recording. So
that's
I didn't
a good,
want to leave that
I'm
off.
Glad you did that because I was listening to the piano keyboard and
so
in particular was amazing.
Right.
And so you said Dexter wrote that tune.
Yeah.
So much of jazz is improvisation and kind of riffing off each other. So was this a written down arrangement then that was given to the keyboardist and the drummer and the bass player where they were actually looking at notes or?
Oh, they probably, he played it for them at the date, not mm-hmm. before. And probably the piano player wrote down the chord changes or something and then put the paper away. I was telling the young musicians recently that had, they had music stands on the stage. They sounded good. I said, you know, if you were really playing with Dexter, you wouldn't have a music stand because he didn't allow a music stand on the stage. And then he would do this thing where he'd have a set list. So he would tell them, okay, we're going to play this, but he always changed it. So his pianist, George Cables, would be like, I didn't even look at the set list because I know it, because he would change it depending on the crowd or how he felt or the response or the weather or whatever reason, you know. So, no, they would learn it, you know, in the studio. Or if it's a standard, which he played often ballads, everybody knew it. And especially I noticed the drummers have like this kind of total recall or photographic memory. I saw that with Art Blakey that, you know, the one time this man said, do you want to hear anything? He had a record collection, and Art Blakey said, yeah, you got that recording of me with Lucky Millinder in 1930-something. This was like 1980, right? And he was, oh, I have that, and he put it on, and Art Blakey knew the arrangement. I was like, well, that's 50 years ago. And he was like, yeah, but if you play it, you remember.
Well, I don't know, but it always seems to me that one of the powerful things about jazz is the way it's never going to be the same twice if it's real jazz.
Right.
And you can see the immediacy of that if you watch the players. I know, you know, my father plays jazz piano, and it's never the same.
Right.
You know, if they recorded it a different time, it wouldn't come out the same. And that's part of its charm is that it. You're there in the moment, and you're playing off the different sounds.
Mm-hmm.
You write in the book about a couple instances in which Dexter recorded things where it was two saxophones kind of dueling it out.
Or different... Wardell Gray.
Yeah, can you talk about that? And maybe we could hear a little of that, too.
Okay, we could listen to The Chase with Wardell Gray. That was on Dial Records, and that comes out of jam sessions that they had in Los Angeles where he said there would be like a whole row of tenor players in the club, and everybody would be playing. But he said for some reason he and Wardell had more stamina, so at 4 in the morning they would be the only ones left. And they played, and they had this communication, and then they did this recording for Dial Records, owned by Ross Russell. And in my research, which his archive is at the Harry Ransom Center in the University of Texas in Austin. So I got a research fellowship because the librarian, I kept calling her and saying, can you send me a photo? Can you look this up? Can you do that? Her name's Del Hollingsworth. And finally she said, we have research fellowships. You could come here and do your own work, which I didn't know they had, right? So I received one. And in his archive, Ross Russell, is a letter he wrote to his mother. And he said, I just recorded this two-tenor track with Dexter Gordon, Wardell Gray, and it's outselling Charlie Parker. I had no idea. We'll be rich. And he never paid a royalty, but he knew that he was going to make a lot of money on that, and he did. And to this day, my accountant was like, you know, you should try to find out how much they sold, but it's impossible.
And when we listen to a little bit of this chase, the duel, how will we know which one is Dexter?
Well, you know, sometimes he didn't know. When he went back, you know, when he made the movie, he went back to listen to recordings because people would ask him, like you. And he was like, I'm not sure if that's me or what. You can tell. There is a certain way. But Wardell would play faster, you know, on those tracks and kind of in a higher register. I mean, I've had saxophone players tell me they could tell. But what one thing Dexter said, if it's, you know, in the battle, they call it battle, but, you know, it's not. It's like a conversation in a way. But he said in the end, Wardell always won. You know, he played better than me.
Is that just Dexter being humble?
No. Wardell came a little before him. And he said, you know, Wardell had more technique and more, you know, of the style because he played with out of Lester Young and not humble, maybe, but he always said he won then, you know. So.
Let's hear
and
it.
He loved him and he died young.
Maxine, you mentioned royalties and something about the money. How did Dexter find out sort of about the business of music? And did he get in some ways exploited like so many jazz musicians did?
Well, yes, of course he did. But all jazz musicians have been exploited, even the ones who made money, because of the nature of the contract. And the way he learned about it was there were certain musicians. One was Gigi Grice, who they paid attention to it, and they started telling guys, you know, don't give your publishing. And Dexter was like, I mean, he wasn't even sure what that meant. But then, in early letters that he wrote to Savoy, to Herman Lubinsky, and the A&R man Teddy Rieg, who wrote a book. I mean, he's so arrogant that he wrote a book called The Biography of a Jazz Hustler. And he tells how they ripped off the musicians, and he's kind of bragging in there. So I thought, well,
that's
so odd. He was like, Herman Lubinsky, who owns Savoy Records, realized that after a gig in New York, that they would go to Harlem and have jam sessions for free. And he said, why? We don't even have to pay them. They play all night for free. And he also had a publishing company where the real money is. And, you know, that's a whole other story. But now we have all the publishing back because my son is in charge of our publishing, and we have a nonprofit. And he studied copyright, international copyright, and he knows about, he knows how to read a contract and negotiate. And so any unreleased Dexter that goes out on what? On a five-year lease. It's a little different. So there's no ownership. Because, in fact, the early contracts on Dial and Savoy have it's almost, I call it indentured, because they own the music for in perpetuity. So in perpetuity are two words that I take a red pen, I cross that out if I ever see those two words, because that means they own it forever and ever and ever. And they're still in the hip-hop contracts. So these young guys who want, and I've been doing a few high schools, and they said, how do you get a record deal? And I was like, try not to get a record deal.
You know, just try to
because
do it yourself.
They think, you know, if you sign a deal, you're going to make money, which mm-hmm. some people do, you know. There are a few people who do make money, but it is a fact. In the period where the jazz musicians were recording and making no money and could hardly pay rent, because I in my book I talk about this. I thought I had read that Miles Davis and Stan Levy, the drummer from Philly, lived together in the 40s, and they played in on 52nd Street. So when I interviewed him, I said, so you had an apartment, you know, where was it? He fell over laughing. He was an apartment. We had a hotel room, and there were like three of us in one bed. And, you know, I mean, no, because I knew they lived together. And so he was like, we couldn't afford an apartment. We couldn't even afford a hotel room. And so, you think about that. But then if you look at it now, it really hasn't improved at all. It's so exploitative. The people who did make money were the gospel groups, because they sold their recordings out of the car. They owned it, and nobody wanted to record gospel until now they probably do. But so they recorded their own records, and then somebody like would sell them, and they made their own money and kept it. You know what I mean? And
right.
I thought, well, how about that model? Right? Mm-hmm.
So. Different model. I want to talk about Dexter Gordon and racism, and we'll do that in a moment when we continue with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Maxine Gordon, widow of legendary saxophone player Dexter Gordon. We're talking about her book, Sophisticated Giant, The Life and Legacy of Dexter Gordon. Dexter, you know, born in 1923, obvious, and, you know, lived until 1990, obviously went through times of great turmoil in terms of the civil rights movement and attitudes towards African Americans. Can you talk about his experiences with race and how that shaped him as a musician and as a person?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, he's born in Los Angeles, and Howard McGhee, the trumpet player, referred to Los Angeles as Mississippi with palm trees because he went out there thinking it's not the South, you know, it'll be better. And when he got there, he found out it was segregated and that, you know, black people couldn't go in many neighborhoods. And the Dexter is born and raised on the east side, it's one word, of Central Avenue. And Central Avenue is the black corridor was. And his father was the second black doctor, like I said. And the hotels were segregated. And the musicians stayed at the Dunbar Hotel. And Duke Ellington and Dexter's father were friends. And actually, in Duke Ellington's book, he says, I was waiting for my friend Dr. Gordon on Christmas Eve when Dexter was 13. And he didn't come because he died that night of a heart attack, he said. Mm-hmm. And it ruined my Christmas.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it was hard on
sure
Dexter.
Did, right.
Sure it was hard on Dexter to only
yeah,
be
very
13.
Hard to be 13, right?
And lose his father.
And, that was difficult. And then...
But Dexter would have had a real role model in terms of a successful father.
Exactly.
Who broke barriers and
right.
Pushed
and the
for
father
education.
Played clarinet. And when he went to Howard University, he played in the Howard Theater, and he loved jazz. And he, you know, so when Dexter was little, saw Duke Ellington, he said to his father, I want to do what they're doing. He was like, that would be a wonderful thing. So it wasn't like he... You know, mm-hmm. went against the middle class idea that the father is a doctor. You're gonna. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So his father loved jazz and thought that he would be proud for his son to be a musician. But anyway, the high school there was very mixed. So he grew up with Mexican, Chinese, Asian, and Japanese until they were, of course, taken to the camps, mm-hmm. right? And black and Irish, which he never thought was white until he found out the Irish later become white. And so when he was drafted, he was already playing, just was going to join Louis Armstrong's band, and he kept trying to avoid the draft notices, tear them up, which doesn't work, and mm-hmm. then they would come to the house and look for you. And so he went, and the story goes that he went down to, it was in a big field where they all had to meet, and then they called the names out. But when they said, colored over here, there's a segregated army in World War II, mm-hmm. They said, colored over here and white over here. And so when they called his name, they were like, moved to the colored section, and he was like, oh, we don't do that. I'm from Los Angeles. So he got disciplined for that, and he was sent to a psychiatrist.
Oh, my.
And he said it was the best thing. There's a scene in the film Round Midnight where the lead is sent to a psychiatrist, which he said he helped write because he said there's always what he said. I mean, it's a stereotype, but he said a Jewish psychiatrist from New York that will get you out of trouble because he explained. He said, I'm not going in the army. I can't go in. I'm not carrying a gun. I'm not killing anybody. My feet are too big to run, and I, you know, will definitely. I'm too tall. He was 6'6". I'll get killed. You know, I'm too tall for this, and I'm a musician, and I can't, I'm not doing it. And the psychiatrist gave him 4F, which he was very proud of.
Well, so it's good that it kept him out of the war.
That kept him out of it. But, you know, when he went on the road with Lionel Hampton, he and his friend, the trumpeter Joe Newman, they decided they wouldn't go in the back door and they wouldn't adhere to segregation in the South. And so they had several incidents where the bus had to go quickly because they were guns. And so he was That, you know, that's when he got the opportunity to leave the country. That, of course, was the main reason also, because he was off parole. And he said if he had stayed in L.A., he'd be dead or in San mm-hmm. Quentin. But when he got to Copenhagen, he met his very good friend Skip Malone, who was the head of the Black Panthers. So he was a Black Panther, and he picketed against the war in Vietnam and that. And so I was like, oh, well, that must have been a really small group of Black Panthers. And he said there were six, but it doesn't matter how many. Bobby Seale came there. And
six Black Panthers in Denmark.
In Copenhagen. Okay. But then they had the Danish supporters of them mm-hmm. that picketed. But
Is any of his involvement with the Black Panthers and protest in general reflected in his music?
Well, he did write this song called The Panther, which we should listen to. And he did it on purpose. Instead of calling it the Black Panthers, he called it The Panther. So people would say, well, are you referring to the Black Panthers when you do that? And he was like, what do you think? You know. So he did that on purpose. So.
And is this something he wrote?
Oh, he wrote that. Wrote this. Oh, yeah. Yeah, The Panther. Yeah.
I hear in that recording, the Panther one, is much more of an edge, you know, a harder syncopation. You can kind of almost hear a subversive quality to it. It sounds different than the earlier recordings. What do you hear in that?
Oh, I never thought about that. Well, you know, as...
Maybe it's just because title Panther and the context of it, but it just had an edge.
Right, right. And it's recorded in 1970. And it's Tommy Flanagan on piano, Larry Ridley on bass, Alan Dawson on drums. So, yeah, I see what you mean. But it also is the period that, as he develops his sound and changes, you know, after being in Europe, because this is, we're still in the period when he's living in Europe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, there is more edge. And it's also after he hears John Coltrane's version of Body and Soul, something changes in his playing because he starts playing Body and Soul in what they call the John Coltrane version instead of the original Coleman Hawkins version. He called it the Dexter Gordon version. But that change, yeah, he changed in that period exactly that. Oh, that's good, Emily. I'll remember that. Yeah, you're right. And it has to do what happened in the death of Dr. King and mm-hmm. Malcolm, and he knew right. Malcolm, and, you know. yeah, that's good.
So you mentioned in your book that Dexter had been called Society Red, just the way Malcolm X had been called Detroit
right.
Red, and that there was some overlap between their lives and experiences. So many artists, writers, musicians went to Europe, this sort of expatriate group that mm-hmm. tried to get away from the racism and a lot of the problems in America. How do you see his European decade, more than a decade, shaping his music? And is there a tune that you can point to that sort of lets us hear that?
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing about the word expatriate is interesting because the only one time I met James Baldwin, we went to this affair or this party, I think it was, in a club. And James Baldwin was there, which was like this great moment for me because one of the things Dexter and I had in common was James Baldwin, that we had all the books and loved his mm-hmm. books and loved him. But Dexter knew him. I didn't know him. And so James Baldwin was there, and he saw Dexter, and he yelled out, "Hey, Dex, I read in the paper we were expatriates. I thought we were just living in Europe. Mm-hmm. So it's a different way of looking at you're still you. You still live your life. That people would tell them what was happening. Plus, they had the Herald Tribune, International Herald Tribune, which they don't have anymore. But they had that. And plus, musicians came back and forth. And so he, to him, he was living there. I mean, he was living in Paris. I mean, in Copenhagen. And, of course, Baldwin lived in Saint-Paul-de-Vence in the south of France. But when he was, he began living in Copenhagen, he loved it there. And he worked all the time. Like in the summer, he'd work a month at a time in Copenhagen in the Montmartre. They had a club. And he had a big following, and he could travel everywhere from there. That was one of the things he said. You know, you can take a train or a plane from Copenhagen and go anywhere in Europe. So he, when I looked at his itineraries, I mean, he went everywhere. He went everywhere in Europe. But he, the song Tivoli, he wrote for the Tivoli Gardens in the central area of Copenhagen. It's a beautiful, they say amusement park, but it's really more than an amusement park. It's just this beautiful setting. And they had concerts there, and he played there, and he went to concerts there. And what he liked was that the music they presented wouldn't be like one kind of music. So they didn't have these genre categories like they have here. You know, they had so classical or jazz or, you know, religious music or any kind of music that was good would be presented there. And he liked that because he didn't like the separation of genres. So he wrote this tune, Tivoli.
Is it true that you met Dexter abroad then? That's mm-hmm. when you come into the story.
Yes.
Can you just tell us a little bit about the first time you met Dexter and what drew you to him?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you see him, you know everybody's drawn to him. So he's a handsome guy, 6'6". But I was working as a road manager in Europe for an agent in Holland, in Wageningen, Holland. And I worked moving the musicians around Europe. That was my specialty. And they moved by train, and I had this big train book, which Dexter, when I met him, he said, is that the only book you read? Because I was always studying the train book. And they sent me to Nancy, France, because it was an imminent train strike. And the band had to get from France to Copenhagen for the next gig. Anyway, they sent me to France. And I never, you know, it's what we call the Dexter Gordon moment. So I walked in the theater. They were already playing. And I heard him, and he had this huge sound, which, you know, you can tell from recordings. But live, it's totally overpowering. There's a story about when Dexter's first gig in Copenhagen, 1962, at the Montmartre, where a man had never heard him in person and came to the club and fainted when he heard the sound. And they became very good friends because when Dexter heard the story, he said, oh, I want to meet somebody who fainted at my sound. And Torben Ulrich, he's still living in his 90s. He lives in Oakland or in California. And his son is Lars Ulrich, the drummer with Metallica, who Dexter is the godfather of that young guy, who's not young anymore. But anyway, we called the Dexter Gordon moment. I heard him, and when I met him, I was like, oh, my God, you know, you need to come back to New York so people can hear this. We don't really have anybody playing like that. And he said, well, I've been thinking about coming back. I'd like to come back. But everybody says there's no audience for jazz. They don't care about bebop. You know, they don't care about rock and roll. And, you know, they're discouraging me, but I'd like to come back. And I said, well, I know Max Gordon, who owns the Village Vanguard. I'll call him and tell him you want to come back, which I did. And, of course, I got a very negative response at first because Max said, no, he's been gone too long. Nobody knows him. Nobody will come. I'm not giving him a gig. And so since I didn't know what I was doing, I said, well, Max, if you don't give Dexter Gordon a gig, I'll never speak to you again. And he was like, I don't care if you never speak to me again. And then he hung up on me. But I called him back because sometimes Max was cranky. And he said, okay, I'll give him a gig in 6 months. I'll give him a week. And so he did. And Dexter prepared for his return. So it was always like, well, we'll try it. And if it works, good. And if it doesn't work, you know, I have a house, I have a bicycle, I can come back to Copenhagen. But it did work, and he signed to Columbia Records. And, you know,
and he became a big success.
He had a very big success on his return.
Mm-hmm. More on the legacy of Dexter Gordon when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Maxine Gordon, and we are talking about her biography, Sophisticated Giant, The Life and Legacy of Dexter Gordon. What would you say the piece of Dexter Gordon's that gets played the most would be?
Well, it would be Cheesecake, the tune. He wrote that tune, and every jazz studies department and every saxophone player learns that tune, and they're always telling me how they transcribe the solo. And then, you know, I tell them, well, don't try to play his solo, try to play your own. But that would be the most airplay everywhere and the most played tune.
Why was it called Cheesecake?
You just like cheesecake.
He liked to eat it.
About his titles is he would write a tune, and then he would think of a title. So he didn't, like, write that because he was thinking about cheesecake. It was kind of, after he heard it, he was, I guess, hungry. He has some other tunes where there's food involved. He has fried bananas. He liked fried bananas. And, you know.
And so before he died in 1990, did he know Cheesecake had become such a popular tune?
Yeah, he did.
He knew.
He did. I mean, people would request it. So.
So let's listen to Cheesecake. Thank you.
That's from the album Go, which is actually Dex's most popular album on Blue Note, and it has Billy Higgins on drums, Sonny Clark, Butch Warren. Sonny Clark on piano, Butch Warren on bass, and Billy Higgins on drums, which he called the perfect rhythm section, until he got the Dream Band with George Cables, Rufus Reed, Eddie Gladden when he came back.
One thing that I like that you wrote in your book, you write, when we listen to Dexter, we know that he brought everything to his music, and the good, the bad, and the ugly were transformed when he played his horn.
Did I say that?
Yes, you did.
Oh, that's that's a sentence earlier. Like
you're talking about how some people, in this case Skip Malone, encouraged you to leave certain parts out of the story. But you included in here the hard times, the dark times, the struggles, the not-so-pretty parts of Dexter's life. But I like the way you also talk about how his music really was deeper because he had those experiences. So even in something called Cheesecake, which you think of something kind of sweet and light, you can hear that the sort of the bluesy, the bluesy sound in there as well. In terms of your own personal response to Dexter's music, I mean, you talk about the Dexter moment when you first heard him playing live, but with all these many different recordings with different groups, different tunes, do you have your own personal favorite?
I had to answer that question by listening to everything, and at first I was like, well, you can't have one favorite because there's so many good moments in his recordings, but then to think about my own, what would I play over and over if I was going to pick one tune? So I picked I'm a Fool to Want You, which is a standard, with Freddie Hubbard. And I pick it because of Freddie Hubbard, because something happens on that recording where Dexter is actually telling a story. You know, the thing about jazz that we love is you don't have to have the lyric, and we hear... I mean, we who love this music and listen, we hear what they're saying, or we feel, or at least we feel like we know what they're saying, which, you know, it probably is not what they're directly saying, but what they're saying to us. So he's telling a story in the beginning of I'm a Fool to Want You, and Freddie Hubbard comes in continuing the thought and the conversation. Totally smoothly enters and does, and Freddie Hubbard is one of the great trumpet players. He had this fabulous technique, which sometimes he showed off, or what we call showed, but in this he doesn't at all. He's just totally playing the tune. And in the movie Round Midnight, he's in a scene which is supposed to be Birdland in New York, and he has a way of looking, and Dexter wanted him in the movie. Freddie Hubbard has a way of looking at Dexter in the Birdland scene that made me remember that tune, because he's thinking about what to play next. It's not just play anything to be on stage. You know, the communication is so great, and that's not to say that every note isn't great in that song, but that's why I like it. I'm a Fool to Want You. Thank you. And that has Barry Harris on piano, Bob Cranshaw on bass, and Billy Higgins on drums. And Billy Higgins was Dexter's first choice drummer.
I was thinking of what a range of sound we've heard that Dexter was able to do, so many different tones and moods. Angela Davis, political activist, called your book, your biography of your late husband, an extraordinary gift. A rigorously researched, jazz-inflected, genre-bending account of the many dimensions of this prodigious life and an occasion to appreciate Dexter's resounding musical genius.
Can't do better than that, right?
I wanted to thank you for sharing the gift of this book and some of the sounds of Dexter Gordon with us here at University of the Year.
Thank you, Emily.
My guest has been Maxine Gordon, and the title of her book is Sophisticated Giant, The Life and Legacy of Dexter Gordon. I'm Emily Auerbach with University of the Air, and we're going to go out with the sounds from Round Midnight. Thank you.